Like father, like son, computer chess, fill the void, the king and the mockingbird of horses and men, an episode in the life of an iron picker, Gloria Metegol, Nymphomaniac 1 and 2, and a story of Jonas Gay. Which of those will win my film of the year and Paul's film of the year? Stay tuned as we find out on episode 24, the final episode of 2014, here on the Outside Centre Film Podcast. Exciting times, Paul.
Indeed, exciting as always.
We've got a lot to get through, but before we get started, we're going to have a very, very brief chat on a rough guide of what we've seen, the percentage of what we've seen, from the massive long Oscar list of last year, 2014, and how we think a lot of those choices that didn't make the final five compared to the ones that did. Now, I'm just going to be blunt about it, Paul. I want The Hunt to stay. Mm-hmm. I think The Hunt is a truly, truly special film that we've talked about quite a few times over the years podcasting. But for me, the other four, utterly disposable.
I thought The Broken Circle.
You were a fan of
that. I was a fan of that.
But I think I could name, easily, we could both name four that are better than A Broken Circle Breakdown. I'm sure we can.
Absolutely. I would say, you know, The Hunt was probably the only one that was really the best of the five that we did see, and we did see well over sort of knocking on 30 of the 80 odd list, if not more, due to various circumstances. And I think, but I think probably The Broken Circle Breakdown I'd probably keep down there. But there was other interesting ones like that I really liked that you hated, like The Wall, the Austrian entry, which we did review. And you really didn't.
Oh, just too much talk. It's just too much talking there. I've been lectured to about things, but even I would put that above The Broken Circle, because I just thought The Broken Circle was, well, we talked about it reasonably early on, I think it might even have been episode two. I didn't like the characters, the whole setup was just strange and unenjoyable for me. I would personally, if I just look at, we've got the list in front of us now, I would put most of these that they've put the tick next to above Broken. I mean, I was actually quite a fan in most parts of the Argentine film Bacolod, the German doctor.
Yep.
And it's interesting that an Argentinian film has also made the semi-final list for Oscars 2015.
Indeed.
But equally, look, we're splitting hairs. What the basic point with why we thought we'd start with this is, it's always worth watching things that don't win or get nominated for things, because you are missing out on so much stuff.
Well, there's three things I'd say. It's always worth listening to what we say. That's the priority.
Absolutely.
Equally, it is worth looking at the list, because, for example, I'd say virtually all of the others that we watched, almost without exception, were better than one that won, The Great Beauty, Le Grand Bel Air. Yeah. Which didn't deserve to win in any chance, but I could see why it did, because it was a filmy
nice big budget,
historical,
justifies
thing.
The whole thing. Doesn't
but
it?
Equally, and in fact, just looking down the list, Renoir, which was France's submission, that wasn't even in the top 50 of French films of that year, let alone the best one for the submission. And I think that's another reason. I know you're not a fan of French film, and I am, but it's worth looking around them as well, because some of them are so much better. And I think the thing about submissions often is they're submitted because they think they're going to win, not necessarily even because
exactly.
They think they're the best ones. They're going to appeal to them. It was about Renoir and art. There's lots of breasts in it, lots of shagging and stuff, which they thought might appeal. But it wasn't even in the top 50 French films of the year. So
I mean, the ones on the list that we haven't mentioned. I mean, the Palestinian film Omar. Once you've seen Family Torn Apart by War, you've seen it a million times.
Yep.
Politically motivated, that was included, I don't know.
What do you think should win an Oscar, though? What's about? I think I'll pick out Heli. Now, Heli was a really good film, and I didn't particularly enjoy it.
Neither did I.
But it picked the genre, you know, the drug dealing thing, and distorted it and twisted and made it original, and that's what should win an Oscar, in my view. Something that does something a lot of other films have done, even if it does it a little bit better, which you could say The Great Beauty did, isn't what about a winner is. A winner is taking something very different and doing it very differently with such originality, sophistication, wit and intelligence that you think, wow. And Heli did that. The Hunt did that. You know, incredible.
I mean, what's interesting about The Hunt is that he got the biggest cheer in the room by far.
Yeah.
And of course, we know that the Oscar ceremony is full of people sitting on chairs. He wouldn't normally give subtitled films the time of day, opposite to us, of course, where we spend most of our days watching them. So, it's a difficult one, because equally, it is hard to be so totally original. We have managed to find some original stuff. And going along the lines of what you said, Brazilian film Neighbouring Sam's we reviewed as well.
Mm.
And again, I didn't particularly enjoy it. You liked it like more than I did. It was your film of the week, I believe. Or joint film of the week.
Yep.
That, again, if you're going to go down the way of how you analyse what a winner should be, that would be my nomination for that reason.
Absolutely.
Because it's a visceral experience of watching a film.
Yep.
What you're seeing, what you're hearing, and of course, every film is what you're seeing, what you're hearing. But this is a real emphasis on what your eyes are picking up and what your ears are picking up. Just the sharpness of colour and sounds for a neighbourhood and its neighbouring sounds was a very, very interesting choice for me. For me, without a question, The Hunt should have won, even irrespective of anything else we've seen this year, film of the year or otherwise. But again, I shouted at Wakanda already. And I was, as I'll talk about later on, even for something that's not necessarily that original, I'm not necessarily seeking perfection or originality. I'm just seeking a good balance of things that you can take from a film yep. and things that you can bring to it yourself.
Yep.
And I think an episode in the life of an iron picker fits that bill. It isn't too long. We'll go into this in a lot more detail later on. But it's a story that works now. And I, generally speaking, I have to say, for a foreign language film, the fact that we have to watch subtitles on these things is because we are going into a world or a country that we probably don't know much about.
Yep.
Certainly in terms of what that story wants to achieve, because we don't understand the language. So for a film to engage us in any way it can with subtitles is the name of the game for me. Mm-hmm. It's at a very, very simple level.
Yep.
And most of these films have done it. Whether I've enjoyed it or not is beside the point. I'm engaged to have an opinion. And it can be something as complicated as the ones we've mentioned already, because Neighbouring Sounds is quite a difficult watch, as are the ones that you've mentioned. But equally, I think for something simple, it can work as well. And that's why I think that Bosnian film stands out. It's one of on the ones that on my list, which we'll be talking about later on, as I say. But speaking of the list, Paul, as we say goodbye to 2014, not quite, because we're going to go through them now. So shall we get on with it?
Okay.
Very quick reminder of the rules, just in case people are joining us right now, in which case, where the hell have you been? Only our film of the weeks are going to be considered. And importantly, of course, therefore, only films that we've actually spoken to you about are going to be considered. Films can also must be released in 2014 on disc or nominated for a major award ceremony in 2014. Now, finally, as a final warning, you can expect, obviously, major spoilers as we dissect and discuss some of the major plot points. We know we haven't exactly hidden spoilers away from even the reviews when we did them first time round, but even more so now. So, you know, this is the very last chance for you to watch the films that we're going to talk about on that 10-strong list. If you want a spoil-free experience, you have been warned. Otherwise, off we go. And the top of the list, Paul, is one of our most recent entries, actually. It's been a good year for Japan, to put it mildly. Like Father, Like Son.
Like Father, Like Son, which is the story of Ryoto Nonimiya, who is a successful businessman, very uptight, very driven, very ambitious. He's got a 5-year-old son, and the hospital where the son was born, ring him up, his family up and say, we swapped your baby by mistake. And then it's about the exploration of him going to meet the family that have his biological son, and the relationship that builds between the father and the son, and yeah. the father and the mother, the father and the other family. And it has everything in it. It's about class, it's about negligence, it's about love, it's about feeling, it's about tradition, what's real, what's illusionary, what you buy into, the city, the urban, it's all in there. And there's not a lot to be said for it other than it was a truly great film. I think, you know, I had a lot of personal connection with it.
You did, yeah.
You know, being sent to a boarding school at the age of 7 and sort of like told to fuck off, basically.
Which is what I'm doing to you now, really.
And the other idea of kind of relationships and what they're built on. You know, is it biological? Is it about what's in the kind of the genetics of the individual? And it parallels that with the genetics of the nation. Or are they just constructs? And I think this was beautifully performed, beautifully directed, very subtle, had multi levels, and was a truly cracking film.
Completely agreed. And it certainly deserves a place on our list. The reason this isn't on our joint list and the reason it's just on you is because my connection was with a story of Jonas Gay. But that isn't to say that this isn't a brilliant film either, because it is. It's an excellent emotional journey throughout all the characters' lives. There's a fair few characters in this film you have to get to know, six, seven. We've got a lot of time. Quite a lot of time, figuratively speaking, to do it, 2 hours. And as well as the stuff you mentioned about some of that I bang on about every single Japanese film, the old Japan, new Japan, all that stuff. One thing that two of the most interesting points for me in this film, first of all, is essentially the gender power swapping.
Yep.
And that is how you would think the rich man is traditionally the one that essentially wears the trousers in the relationship, but it's not the case. It's actually the housewife in the rich family that's very strong. And that swaps depending on what family you're in. So for the rich side, she's essentially the one that makes all the important decisions, whereas in the poor family, he does. Even though he's the one that's working in the poor family as well. So it's that was really, really interesting. My favourite moment of this film, and I have to say, this is a moment when the film clicked for me. Because, of course, he's torn, isn't he, the father? He's torn between who is my son and what kind of father am I? For a good hour of the film, he cannot make his mind up whether he wants his biological son, you know, the bloodline son, or the emotional son in the sense of the one that he's brought up throughout his life. And he can't make his mind up. And then that wonderful camping scene happened that you talked about in the episode. But before that happens, it just clicked for me when his father shot his son through the slightly ajar door. And I know that sounds like some sort of a strange South African kind of disabled athlete kind of story. But in the nicest possible way, this happened here, because they were play fighting, and a lot of the time in the film, there's play fighting and just general playing. The father would always have something else to be doing, either working or arguing with the wife, or just working in the house, on his job, not in terms of even helping out. He never had time for his son. This is the moment where he finally realizes, I've made my decision. I'm now going to play with my, in inverted commas, real son. And that scene is an absolute joyous moment. It goes on for about 5 minutes. You just see them playing. And at that point, I was emotionally hooked. Never mind the incredibly beautiful acting of the ending, Paul. When, you know, a decision is made and the child doesn't quite understand what it all means and he goes running off down the street. I think at that point you were crying.
Yep.
I can't have been that too far away from it either. So all I can really say elsewhere for one final point is that this film makes me want to have children. And that is
That's impressive.
That is the highest praise I can give any film, no? Surely.
Absolutely. And one of the other things that's interesting is the use of photography in it. And I think it explores the use of photography quite well. In looking at whether you know you're photographing something to be an instant memory rather than living in the moment and actually enjoying what you have and where you are,
and that works for Jonas Gay as well, which we'll talk about later.
Absolutely. And I thought the use of photography in those two Japanese films is very interesting again, because there is that whole thing about Japanese culture being obsessed with photography. You know, like we have these cliches of all these Japanese tourists turning up with cameras, and just rather than them being in the moment and enjoying the moment, and it's that balance between the two. And I think absolutely, and I think a great film.
DreamWorks Studios have acquired the rights to a remake.
Oh God!
It's to be directed by Chris and Paul Weitz, who will direct together for the first time since About a Boy. So if that's anything to go by, you need to fucking see the Japanese version.
Absolutely.
And you've got plenty of chance to do it. It's available on streaming and disc buying and all sorts. Wonderful stuff.
And it's meaningful. It's not sentimental.
No.
And in fact, it's interesting because talking about all the Oscar ones we were talking about earlier that did get through to the final, their link is their sentimentality. They all have a degree of sentimentality that actually the films we preferred didn't have. And although this is an incredibly emotional experience, it's not sentimental, it's real. Unlike say About a Boy and those kind of shit films that they like make. So Absolutely, get this one.
Very, very interesting start to the podcast. Then let's move on to, that was the first off of your list.
Yep.
Now we move on to the first on my list.
And it should be, it should be pointed out, we do vary quite a lot as we go along.
We do, as it should be, surely.
Yep.
The joys of watching things outside the mainstream. Computer Chess. Computer Chess is a mockumentary set in the 80s following various programmers and their quest to create and program the first chess computer programming system to beat a human being at chess. Your face has already changed.
Yeah.
And I know you are amazed it's even made it onto the list. Now,
that's true.
Like A Ping Pong Summer, this was a hit at Sundance. And like A Ping Pong Summer,
it's shit.
It was filmed. It was filmed in an homage to cinema from a different era. Unlike A Ping Pong Summer, Computer Chess was not a total load of fucking shit. Paul, I'm happy it's on my list. I think it honestly deserves a place there. The main thing, and I'm trying to be diplomatic about it, the main thing in its favour is originality. Style, content and delivery of all of the above is interesting and unique, not only for the podcast, perhaps not only for 2014, but also, I would argue, for decades previous. It's humorous. I think it's humorous. Well acted and well made by Andrew Bajalski, who does the whole shebang himself. He writes it, he produces it, he directs it, which is not to be sniffed at. I'm always supporting people who are good and who think,
except in this case,
who are good enough to do it. It was partly funded by Kickstarter, as many American indie films are, potentially, as well as the one that you made me watch about that bloody police. Strange Police Force, Clear History, I think it was. Was it Clear History?
No, that was
Larry
David.
Well, no, that's not that. Whatever it was, but obviously not great.
Obviously gone from both of them.
Yeah, well, indeed. But look, I've said all honestly what I can say about it. It's not for everyone. There's no doubt about that. So why were you so against...
Well,
listening back to the episode, actually, Paul, going back to episode 4, you weren't...
You've got a sad life.
No. I'm just saying, I haven't listened back to it, but it's on episode 4 if people want to do it.
Right.
But what the only thing I can remember you saying is that you didn't mind it. You just wish it was more expansive, which I think is quite an interesting point of view, which we'll come back later. What were your problems with Computer Chess?
Well, I think it was all the things you said. It wasn't enough of that. So it was interesting, and it was a little bit original, and it was a little bit humorous, and it was a little bit interesting. And that's why it was okay. It needed to be a lot funnier if you're going to go with humour. And I think it was trying to go with a lot of humour, but it just didn't really work. The originality of kind of like using the technology of the early 80s, video cameras, you know, VHS.
Getting all those lovely old computers in.
Exactly, and doing that. And I think it needed to... in a way, explore them a little bit more originally. So, it was a bit slow. It felt very long. And in fact, it's only 92 minutes. So take out the titles. It's about.
And yet you praised Gold for being deliberately slow and deliberately long.
I think that's because it was about a journey. Whereas this journey, the journey of this was a very short period of time. It was a competition. It didn't build up any particular drama. And I thought that they were more cliches than characters, and I think so it was okay, and I thought it was a nice try. I'd like to see what he does in the future, and I think it'll take him 3 or 4 films, I think, to hit his stride to before he makes something really good, unless he gets sucked into commercial drivel, which is what happens to a lot of them. But it was just okay, and I think for a lot of the reasons you said you liked it, it was those things weren't enough of it. So, and I think the humour, I think it lacked that. It was that I think it thought it was very funny, and it wasn't. And I think you needed to be able to deliver on that a lot more. And I didn't like, there were some personal stories about kind of like the religious group who were in another room.
More over the swingers group, really.
The
sexual and health well-being group.
And I thought that needed to be funnier. Or just more shocking, either, but not just like, oh, that's what they are. That's what he's going with here. So I thought it was clever, clever but not particularly intelligent. And I think there's a big difference between those two. And it reminded me of a very, it, if it turned out Bajalski grew up in England, I wouldn't be surprised. Because it was that kind of very clever middle classness that you get of a lot of British cinema. That's,
I agree, actually.
That's fundamentally
yeah.
a bit shit. So, but it was okay, and it's good to see someone doing something different, because I think culture relies on kind of stealing good ideas off of talented people, and I can see someone using this kind of idea of the technology of the era to make a film being used quite a bit because of this film, and that's to its credit.
Well, it may need to have been more in some aspects, but at least it actually had something to hold on to.
Yeah.
Fill the void.
Yeah. Which, again, I think I can see your face dropping. Because
which was deliberately boring, but so. In a good way, no?
I didn't think it was boring at all. I thought it was exciting from beginning to end and had a beautiful lead, which how the sexist of me is true. It's about a young Hasidic Jewish woman who's pressured.
Sadistic.
Who is pressured into an arranged marriage to an older widower who was married to her sister who had a baby with this bloke. And then it explores a culture, the kind of hardcore Hasidic Jewish culture of Israel that I knew nothing about, so I thought that was interesting. It was about the relationship between men and women, the oppression of women, the delusional power of men, about sex, lust, naivety, and kind of like almost kind of an incestuous desire of not stepping out of the confines of your own community, let alone outside of your own family. I thought it was a very intense, claustrophobic piece that in a way Compute Chess should have been a bit more of, that wasn't, that this delivered on. And I thought the way the woman, the characters progressed and changed, the relationships was so beautifully delivered. It was short, it was snappy, it had an intensity to it that I think made it, it was up there with going to be one of the films of the year for me in the final like one or two that I will pick. It was there because I think it was that good. And it was more because I wasn't expecting it to be that good. I think, and again, it was probably a problem that Computer Chess suffered from. I was expecting it to be better than it was. And expectation plays a lot in how you view a film. And I think you chose Fill the Void to watch. You said, let's watch this one, because you often know more than me. And I watched it thinking, oh, God, this is going to be shit.
And you were right, actually.
And so I think expectation, and I thought, man, this is fantastic. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I mean, there are two films on this list with You Weren't So God-Awful This Year on the podcast. one of your films should have been on this list. And this is the first one. One of your films, any of your films that would have been good enough for the list should have took the place to Fill the Void. The title itself, Fill the Void, the whole film is a void that is never filled with anything but naivety. And it's quite interesting that you say you learn so much about the Jewish sect. I still don't know nothing about the Jewish sect, apart from that people have long hair and that the women are forced to have children. And that is what this film is about. Except it's not. Because all the way through the film, we do meet this young Hasidic Jewish woman. And she's adamant, I do not want a child, I am not interested in a child, I don't even want to marry people. What happens throughout the entire film? She starts to weaken a bit, but she's still steadfast for most of the film. And then, the last few scenes, oh, go on, then I'll have a baby and get married then. Just the whole thing falls on its arse right at the end. It could have made some real points about a woman's desperate struggle. This is a great... It fits in greatly to a general theme throughout this year. Well, we've seen some films that haven't made the list as well that are full of strong, independent women. It's a really interesting theme, and it's one that I've enjoyed seeing, one that I didn't really know people cared that much about, but it's in a lot of the films that were on this list and also ones that didn't make it, as I've said. This would have been the best, or one of the best examples of that, of a strong, pressurised woman who against all the odds manages to have the life that she wants to have, and the whole thing is wasted in the last 10 minutes because she decides, or the director decides, let's just make her have a child in the end anyway.
Or the culture decides, the family decides. And I think that's why I like this, because again, I think we often see films about strong independent women who kind of create a life for them, but the reality is they are the minority by far who in society who actually achieved that. Most of us, and it's true of men and women and children, are crushed into submission to a kind of delusion of normality that we go on living by. You and I may be the exception to this in our glorious city, but the reality is most people, and actually this shows that you can start off thinking about your dreams and your hope and your expectations, and then everything around you will conspire to just kick the shit out of you and make you conform and be what everybody else wants you to be. And I thought that's why was a great
which point. Would have been fine, except she didn't have dreams, she didn't have aspirations, and whether that's because of the sect pressurizing her,
yep,
but for this to work as a film, she had to have aspirations for me to grab onto and understand, and therefore when it fails I can sympathize with her. She didn't have any. Her only aspiration was not to have a baby. Therefore, for the film to say, you are now having a baby in the final few scenes, get on with it, was awful.
But
it was
I think that's an awful design choice. No, I can see why you think that. And again, I think that is the traditional narrative that one would want. But what was good about this is, again, most people don't know what their dream is, which is why the little hope that they do have, which is not to be like everybody else, is so easily crushed. And I thought this delivered that. It was pretty low on dialogue. It was all about emotion, and I think it looked beautiful. She looked beautiful, and it was just it. And I like that you know, you just don't want to be what everybody else is, and yet we all just become that.
But it would have,
and in a way, it's an anti-climax, bit like the ending.
But it would have been far more original if it hadn't gone that way.
No,
if she had got what she wanted.
No,
Well, do they?
Yeah, I think so.
I think they do, is not the same as it actually happens. So you mentioned hope. This didn't have any hope. It was a disastrous film.
Well, I would say I would agree with that, and I think that shows we watched the same film. But actually, that's why I liked it, because it didn't. It sort of said there isn't any hope, and there isn't for most people. So yeah.
On to the next one, then. I think the best thing I can say, The King of the Mockingbirds, my favourite animation of 2014. Will it be my favourite film of the year? We'll find out. It's about a chimney sweep and a shepherdess who seek to escape from the clutches of a tyrannical king. They escape from a painting on a magical moonlit evening and swan off, and the king is replaced by his own painting, a doppelganger. And this is a French animation, a long-lost French animation from the 1980s, based on a Hans Christian Andersen short story. I'm feeling generous, Paul. I'm feeling generous. What is the name of the short story that this is based on? Go on. 1, 2, 3.
Heidrun og Skorstensfönstern.
You forgot Philly.
I was saying, I really
forgot the F. You forgot the F bit there.
That 20-letter final
mostly not bad. And I've got very few notes on this, Paul. Because, first of all, it's in my head, because we've obviously done it very recently. But also, one word that sums this film up, and why it deserves a place on my own list, is the word stuff. It is full to the brim of stuff.
Oh, I thought you meant my word. I couldn't give a stuff.
No, we've just finished with Phil the Boy. Let's move on. The King of the Mockingbird is absolutely full of symbolism. It's and this more than any animated film this year gives me hope. Ironically enough. Going back as we
you
are.
Young people who want
to hope. Going back to the 1980s and to pick up long lost bloody animation films that were never released to the wider public gives me hope for the future. Because Frozen at Christmas was a TV show on Channel 4, I believe, Paul, where they sat down a whole bunch of celebrities to talk about why their children think Frozen's the best thing. Frozen is the fifth biggest grossing film of all time. And yet it's this god awful, vacuous.
Proof that there is no hope.
It's a word we'd like to use a lot, but it really is true for Frozen. It's about nothing. It's a Snow Queen ripoff.
Yep.
The animation's not even that special. The music is awful. A complete contrast to this that is original, although it is based on a short story. It's got a fairy tale aspect of magic to it, which ironically enough for people dallying about wearing fucking dresses, singing about opening doors. It's amazing how unoriginal like that can actually get.
Well, I'm glad you want children now, but I just hope you don't have a daughter.
No,
because you love Frozen and you want to kill
her. If only if it was just daughters. If only if it was just them. That's half of the problem. But anyway, this, The King of the Mockingbird, considering its time. Now, we had a bit of doodah about how, you know, looking back on things and whether it stands to test time or not. I don't regard that as important at all, because this animation obviously looks worse than Frozen. And looks worse than a lot of more recent animation films, but it's packed full of charm, character. Whether it is because of that style, I don't know. But all I can say is what's in front of me. And what is in front of me when I watch The King of the Mockingbird is a time when animation film was brilliant, or at least the style of it was brilliant. Technologically, there are some really interesting scenes. For example, again, like I mentioned on the podcast, where we talked about this film in more depth, when he breaks the mirror and you can see the reflection of him cracking away one his, because he doesn't like himself, he knows he's ugly, and that's what he hates about himself more than anything, hence why he has a portrait painted to make himself look better, but even that's not enough, and he gets upset about it and smashes the mirror. But the animation for that particular scene was great. I love the sense of depth, and this is such an underrated thing. One of the great things about the Pixar film Up is a sense of depth when they get to the waterfalls. And even when he's flying in the air, and even in the house, there's more, you actually feel like you are in this enclosed space, but there's so much going on. What you see in animation films is only as good as what's around it. Mm-hmm. And this is, even though there is hardly anything on screen in the city in The King of the Mockingbird, there's a lot of empty space and tall buildings only. That's pretty much it. Blue sky, tall buildings. There is a great sense of depth, of wealth, of richness in the city of The King and the Mockingbird. Sonically, as I've said, kids will be bored shitless by this because there are no songs in it. It's orchestral music, the very best kind of orchestral music, because it goes across the whole range, and it's used in the film admirably. But going back to the stuff, which is not, I know you're going to come into it because it's what you enjoyed the most about it. You've got the French revolutionist side, you've got the Cold War side. But of course, like all good films, like all the very best films, you can't ignore that stuff because it's right there and it's presented well. But if you don't want that, it does work as a fairy tale. Now, luckily for you, as someone who doesn't like fairy tales, it was the stuff that made you enjoy King of the Mockingbird.
Well, I live in the Midlands, so obviously I do believe in fairy tales. But it's funny because I think when I watched this, I didn't particularly like it per se. I thought it was very dated, but actually, in retrospect, it's a lot better than an initial reaction to it. I think I loved its kind of Cold War capitalist kind of critique that's in there as part of the fairy tale, and all fairy tales are incredibly political, and that's the whole point of it. Which I thought was really good. Actually, I'd agree with you. I think it's a really good animation, and it probably does stand the test of time. The thing is, if not to have watched another kind of modernist animation sort of close to it, which I think I had, that made it detract from it. And I think there's a lot of originality to it that was plagiarised by others. I think The Iron Giant.
It's very, very, very plagiarised by The Iron Giant.
Absolutely, which I see as a compliment rather than a kind of criticism. Yeah. I think The Iron Giant bit is really very good. And again, you can see it as being quite a kind of crash metaphor. Not crass metaphor, but actually it's kind of, I mean, this time it was incredibly original, innovative. The drawing is both simple yet sophisticated. I love, and there's a lot of movement to the direction of this, and I think the movement of it adds to it enormously. And I would say I'd agree with you. It's not my favourite animation of the year, because I think we'll come to that one later. But I did enjoy it. I thought it is well made. It is fairly short, which is always a benefit to a fairy tale, I think. And I think there's not a lot to be said for it other than I agree with mostly what you said. I think it is better in retrospect than I thought it was. And I think that shows you how something can grow on you after you've seen it and thought about it. And then seen a lot of other modern animations, particularly over this Christmas period when there's a lot of animation on the television, that you do think, oh, God, they're shit, that everybody loves, and yet this will hardly see the light of day, and in fact it should.
It took 20-odd years, 25 years plus to see the light of day.
Yep.
Even more, really. So, good stuff. I'm very glad. I'm, It was between this, as I said to you off airport, it was between this and the Congress. This does wipe the floor with the Congress. I will defend the Congress because you've made me watch some fucking shit, and I've made you watch a little bit as well. If it was executed slightly better and a bit more tidy, the Congress would be on here, but I can only judge on all levels. The King of the Mockingbird just succeeds at what it wanted to do.
I'm just proud that I've made you pick a French film for your list. Oh, you got a little bit anxious there.
Ironically enough, you had absolutely no input in this whatsoever. In fact, judging by this list, there's just a fair lack of Paul's influence, but never mind.
But you picked a French film, that's what I like.
We're not going to win anyway. So, so then, Paul, let's go on with your next choice from your own personal list, and again, it's another recent one. Yep. Of Horses and Men.
Hieros y Os.
I was quite generous in giving you the Danish.
Oh, but that one's easy. Even you can say that.
Okay.
It's a country romance about some people in Iceland, the kind of bleak area of Iceland. It's love and death interlaced with immense consequences, the fortunes of the people of the country through a horse's perceptions. And it is literally almost entirely from a horse's point of view, which is not their kind of POV, sort of directly through their eyes.
Although there is that, I think, once or twice.
Yeah, there is that once or twice. But it's almost like it's the horse's environment that these humans are sort of engaging in. And it is a brilliant film. I think it's short. It's 81 minutes. Again, it's not overladen with dialogue. It's about people living in an environment which I personally couldn't bear. that's bleak, that's cold, that's green, that's wet. That is Iceland, basically. And it's about the way that affects people in what they do, how they interact with one another, how they interact with those things, the environment, and equally strangers who come to it, about how one picks love, how one performs relationships. Much like horses perform a kind of routine in a courtship, you see that kind of paralleled in the people's behaviour. There's some quite shocking scenes. I think there's one of the Mexican or the Spanish kind of person is there trying to survive in relation to a horse.
And since we've warned about spoils, he actually cuts open his horse, takes out the entrails and climbs inside the carcass of the horse.
And it saves his life in a kind of bleak snowstorm that everybody thinks he's dead.
Which is one of the things that I got out of this film, was it's the delicate nature between the horse and the human. There can be so much love, and yet the relationship can be cut short at an instant.
Absolutely.
Like any relationship in real life.
Absolutely.
Take a gun to your partner's head, God forbid. That can happen as well. It's the human nature thing that Haneker does very, very well as well. We talked about it as well.
Yep. It's about how humans, and I don't think it just means Icelandic humans, are as much an animal as the horses that they are.
But it does fit into the Scandinavian human.
It does.
There's no two ways about this.
It does. And I think it's, again, it is one of the best films of the year. And I think, again, it comes back to that expectations. Because, again, I've known about this film for all year. And I think it was in the Oscar list last year that didn't get through to the final. I've known about it and I've seen the advertisements. And I think it even got a bit of a kind of theatrical release in the art houses here. And I thought, oh, God, I really don't want to see that. I really don't want to see that. And then I've watched it and thought, wow, this is fantastic. What have I been missing? I think I love the use of colour, of light, of dark, of shade, and the acting was excellent. Yep. I think the main lead, who was also the star in Jar City, which is another really bleak kind of mystery thriller set in Iceland that I'd recommend if he's the star of that, he's the star of this, which again is a kind of very kind of dark, miserable. It doesn't make you want to go to Iceland particularly, either for the people or for the environment. I think this was going to be one of my top films. This will be potentially the best film of the year, with one or two others that I shall whittle down for the end of the podcast.
It was okay. This is the second film that I wish you had produced something bigger from yourself to put it on your own list. I just thought it was okay. I thought the performances were good, but nothing particularly exciting. My big problem with this film, though, was that I enjoyed it the most the first 10-15 minutes. And after that, it kind of started to recycle the same ideas in a slightly different way. I got the horse, the streak of human in horse and the streak of horse in human. I got that. Now what else can you do with it? The only other time I was really impressed with that notion, that I found it entertaining, interesting to watch, enjoyable to watch. Not that entertainment is necessary, of course. But for something like this, I think it actually needed a bit more obvious humour. Because the subject already was quite dark. And the humour already was quite dark. It just needed something to lift it. Because at the point when he cut open his own horse and climbed in, I thought, this is actually far too heavy now. And yet that does come at the end with the mating scene, I suppose we can call it.
Yep.
And there was a bit before where you do see a horse's penis.
Yeah.
In the first, again, but that comes back to the first 10-15 minutes where I really did enjoy the film.
The first 10-15 minutes are fantastic.
I just felt it slipped a bit after that.
Well, I would agree, but again, it would be difficult not to, because they were a fantastic opening 15 minutes.
I mean, I would totally agree. I would actually even, considering I'm just calling the film okay, that the first 10-15 minutes are actually much better than okay. And they raise it; it just drops down considerably for me afterwards. But it doesn't. It doesn't mean it hasn't tried, and it has tried something different. And I applaud it for that. And I would recommend it, despite me just being passable for me. It's sometimes it is hard to distinguish why you love something and I don't. There's just something tangible that one of us is not getting that the other one is getting. Because I remember what I've said in the past, and I've also said that. You know, humour isn't necessary sometimes, and yet sometimes it is. Sometimes it's not dark enough, sometimes it's too dark. So just to get the pitch-perfect balance, it wasn't there for me, but it was there for you. But either way, as with most of the films on this list, if not all of them, I would like to think that even the ones that we don't agree on, we would recommend them all, and that is kind of
Absolutely.
The point.
Absolutely.
That is the point of this. And I will watch his next film... Because I think he's got some talent there. I just wish, for me, it was a bit more constant in this particular film.
Mm.
But no two ways about it. It's a beautifully shot film. And if anyone can shoot a film beautifully, they're on the way to something, as far as I'm concerned.
Yep.
So, speaking of brevity, something that you regard as very important.
I'm a big admirer of.
I'm not. And yet, here is my brevity film. Mentioned it already. An episode in the life of an iron picker. Wonderful. It's a brevity film, as we said, Paul. A Bosnian film about essentially a refugee family, or at least a family who are very poor, and a day in the life of them as the husband struggles to make ends meet and pay for much needed healthcare to keep his wife alive. She's got abdomen issues.
Yep.
And it does turn quite serious. And essentially, it's a very short film. This puts the B in brevity. 75 minutes. Incredible.
Snappy.
1 hour and 15. It's got to be some sort of a record, hasn't it, for a feature-length film?
It has, indeed.
It's to say this is, in contrast, interestingly, to Of Horses and Men, this is not very cinematic, but to say the least. This, however, like Of Horses and Men, this is actually quite miserable, to say the least. But at least this film has hope. I didn't get hope and fill the void at all. This, for me, gives me hope. Bundles of hope. Which is more than all of the stuff you bloody made me watch over the course of this podcast, Paul. He never gives up. Time and time again, the husband never gives up. Whenever something goes wrong, he found a way around it, either with humour, help from his friends. Eventually, his wife does recover, and they live in a destitute condition, it must be said. But together... healthy and with hope in their hearts. Such a simple, effective narrative with engaging real characters, which, as you know, are very important to me. This is exactly my kind of foreign language film, and all I can say is that I thought it was brilliant.
It was okay. You know, I think its strength is its brevity. It is a very miserable film.
No, that's...
And I didn't get that kind of hope that you do. I got kind of survival at best out of it.
Remarkably similar to With Horses and Men, really.
Indeed, yes. Although there's a bit of sex in With Horses and Men between horses
and women. Between horses and horses.
And with a lot more humour. I think it was probably a bit too bleak for me. I think is it Romanian?
You said 8 Ball. You sat there and praised 8 Ball. For its misery, which is a damn sight longer than this.
Well, in a way, I don't have a problem. I do not have a problem with misery for misery's sake and hopelessness for hopelessness' sake. I think this is where this got a little bit confused and lost its message. That it was kind of like a little bit hopeful, despite the fact that their life was going to remain as shit and struggling as it was. And the only hope was that they might survive. And in a way, it's kind of like, I think it needed a bit more. It's a difficult thing to say, because I suppose I want more politics, but it was actually pure politics in itself about how this is how we force people to live in our society, and that is dreadful, particularly when you charge for medical health care and you become with kind of bureaucracy about medical and health care and all of those kind of like real true evil things in contemporary societies. But again, I liked it. I did like it, and I thought it went quite snappily. I thought the performances were really good. I thought it was almost documentarist in its kind of dissection, almost of the misery of certain people's lives in a very short period of time. And that was to its credit. And again, I'd recommend people see it, because again, it told me about a kind of culture and a kind of marginalised people within a foreign culture that I don't know anything about, which is always a good thing. Whether I sit there and love it or not.
And thank God we don't know anything about it, because it must be a horrible place to live.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know that from all the news reports, never mind films like this that are putting a slant on it.
Absolutely. So, and I did think, I liked the people in it, I liked the characters, and I thought it was well acted. So again, I'd recommend it, but, you know, I wouldn't have had it as one of my films of the year. So.
It's interesting that you praise Fill the Void for doing exactly the same thing that you dislike this film doing. The confused message. False hope.
But I didn't.
The acceptance of.
No, because I didn't think Fill the Void had that. I thought it did have a kind of logical narrative of hopelessness. Whereas this kind of like swings between, oh, this is really hopeless, or there is hope, or they might think they will survive. And it's kind of like, ooh, you know, where are you going to go with this? And then in the end, it just sort of like tomorrow's going to be exactly like today. Whereas in fact, in Fill the Void, her life's over. Even though she's going to be better off than this lot and have more of a fulfilling life than this lot, probably, it is over for many.
Not logical to be so anti-baby and then major baby right at the end. That's not logical at all.
Because her life is over. But again, I would recommend it. And I think I did enjoy it. It was interesting. And I think it would be interesting to see what the director-writer, again, writer-director.
Well, it's interesting that this is actually now available on DVD to buy. Right. Which I'm very surprised. I'm delighted it is, and I'll be picking it up in the future. This gives me hope that, or at least I hope it would inspire other poorer European nations get their stuff over to us. We'll talk about it, we'll review it, and if we like it, we buy it. And that is what I want. A lot more films from the list that we weren't able to get. You know, obviously it's easy for us to sit, you know, sit here and say it. But you do wonder whether sometimes people just give up before they even try to get things sold to the UK distributed. I would like to see a lot more stuff like this, believe me. So let's hope for 2015 we have a bit more luck on that.
Absolutely.
Let's move on then to, since we are supposed to be working together on this, we are done with our individual lists of films, and there have been some bloody good ones. Now it's time for some joint ones, starting with what, for me, is probably the biggest surprise of the year. Tell us about Gloria.
Gloria, it's basically about a recently divorced, middle-aged, free-spirited woman called Gloria, set in Santiago in Chile. And it's the realities of her whirlwind romance with a former naval officer who she meets while she loves to go out dancing and meeting and people and stuff. And it turns out, you know, he's a married man and he doesn't want to end his family life. And it's sort of like you see her go through this romance and then the bitter reality of its ending. You know, he takes her away for a weekend in a nice place and she gets drunk and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And it was about a real woman. And in a way, that's what's great about this film. It's about a real woman in a real environment. It's about a middle-aged woman. She's not startlingly attractive. She's not ugly. She's ordinary, wears glasses, has an ordinary job. The ordinariness of it is extraordinary kind of content that makes it the great. Again, writer-director, Sebastian Lelio. Lelio, or I want to say it in Spanish. And it's quite a long film, you know, just under 2 hours. But again, whizzes along because you really get involved with her and you meet her family, her ex-husband, her new lover, and then the experiences she has in trying to just be happy in the ordinariness of her life and the ordinariness of who she is. And for that, it's an excellent film.
And I say this is the biggest surprise because this really brought home to me the theme of strong, independent women, which I didn't get in Fill the Void, but we did get in a lot of the other ones that we talked about on other episodes of the podcast that aren't on this one today. Another surprise for me was the use of music. I think you've probably gathered for yourselves that I am not the biggest music fan unless it's a film about music. Mm-hmm. I dislike music because I think it distracts, it annoys, it adds very little that something that you could see, characters' faces could do an equally, if not better, job. My favourite moments, again, as I mentioned when we talked about this in more depth, I love the disco scenes, different stages of their relationship. When they were a bit unsure, the music was a bit slower paced, and then as the two got to know each other, it quickened up, it got more vibrant, more saucy. It was a wonderful, wonderful cinematic experience.
You just said saucy.
Saucy.
I'm impressed.
The characters are brilliant in this. Mm-hmm. And there ain't that many of them. And that has the benefit as well as there being lots, if you can pull it off. Both her and him are superb. I must say, as much as I enjoyed her, I think I liked him even more. What a Weasley character. Mm-hmm. A brilliantly acted love interest. And what I like most about him, even though we are presented this what we will get to know as a Weasley character who can't stand up on his own two feet or whatever, there is no real explanation why he's like that. There are hints, of course, that he has a family, but most of us have families and most of us have other people in our lives to fall back on. There's excellent use of ambiguity in this. So we don't know whether it is solely because of his overpowering relationship with his own daughter. That's why he's a bit offish with Gloria sometimes. It could be, but equally there's things that we don't know about him. And that adds to the film. He's got a great sense of mystery for him. You know, is he actually just a weak person? Even with the family taken into account, he's just not very good at making himself presentable with Gloria. Is he too noble with the family? Is he too noble with her and gets embarrassed and runs away? Scared? It could be any of those things. You know, weak, withering, determined, proud. One of the most pleasant surprises of 2014. Both characters are all of those things and yet none of those things. I particularly, as I said before, I really enjoyed the presentation of Gloria. She is strong and independent. And yet, as you said, she is ordinary looking.
Yep.
And yet, at moments in the film, they made her to look beautiful. Yep. And at other moments, they really made her look like, you know, and I'm going to offend people.
Your grandma.
A decrepit pensioner.
Yep.
But decrepit emotionally as well as physically.
Mm-hmm.
So I reckon, honestly, she and him, but I'll say particularly he, but Gloria has stood out for me as one of the strongest, most original characters, and the acting performance, I believe, won her the prestigious Silver Bear, and I'm delighted it did. And I'm also delighted this film was picked up on one of the obscure BBC channels.
Indeed.
BBC 3 or 4, probably 4. So I'm glad that it came over. And I would really recommend this.
I would too. And I think it is probably in the top 5 films of the year, for me personally. Probably in the top 3. The more you think about it, the more you love it. And I think the key thing for me is you've had a lot of films recently, particularly foreign films, exploring the notion, and British films, of older people having sex, which is, I found to be a little bit crass often.
A bit desperate as well.
Because actually, this is about a woman, and she does have sex, but she lives a life. And actually, not outside of it, but sex is part of life. So it's an integral part, but not the sex is the integral part, but the life is the integral part. Yeah. And I think it, and I slightly disagree on the fact that she's a kind of like strong woman. Again, I think what I would come back to is she's an ordinary woman who has to live the extraordinariness of ordinariness and just get up every morning and keep living, keep trying to enjoy, build relationships and have a life. And that is the greatness of her and of this film. But and it was nice that it didn't get sidetracked, as quite a lot of few recent films have about, you know, oh, look, these middle-aged older people have sex. And I think it didn't suffer from that, which was to its great advantage. And it was about seeing it's a holistic picture of her that is incredibly rewarding to watch, to experience and to see. And again, I really like the music as well.
The reason I call her strong is because she isn't naive.
Yeah.
That's what I meant really by it, unlike the certain person from Veil of the Void. Gloria is not naive enough to kind of accept what she has to accept. Like, the relationship, you know, let's talk about the end of the film now, the relationship doesn't happen, and yet she still could not be happier. She goes back to what she loves doing, her dancing and the music and she knows
she has to get up and try again.
That's right. And the end song,
yeah,
whilst being borderline sentimentally cheesy almost, I think they get away with it.
Remind me what it was.
It was just a song with the lyric Gloria, wasn't it? Gloria.
That's right.
A pop song.
Van Morrison.
That's it. And she's dancing to that. She realises, right, I am Gloria. This song is my song. And I'm going to get up and carry on living.
Yep.
From the table. She was actually sitting at a table drinking, I believe, at that point. And you think, oh, that's going to be her sitting there miserable by herself and drinking herself to oblivion. No, she puts a drink to one side, wine glass or cocktail glass.
Absolutely.
Puts that to one side, gets up, dances to a song called Gloria. What a magnificent film.
Indeed.
So I'm afraid for the next one, Paul, it gives the game away a bit, because I've already mentioned my favourite animation of the year, and therefore how it can't possibly, this one cannot possibly win film of the year 2014 for me. But there's a chance for you. That said, Metagol, and I believe we're going to have to go back to episode 11 for the Football Film Special podcast.
Indeed.
From the last time we talked about Metagol. AKA Underdogs, which, have you seen the British version?
No, I have not, and I shall not.
And I shall not either, so we're talking specifically about Metagol, which is the Argentinian-specific version. A team of fussball players come to life in the aid of saving an Argentine town from being turned into a commercialised catastrophe. Now, as I say, Paul, clearly I've given the game away. This is not even my favourite animation, so if it's not my favourite animation, how can it win Film of the Year? It won't. But it is by far the best new animation I've seen this year, because it's beautifully filmed with excellent detail, lots of depth, even on these simple fussball characters. You can see splinters, you can see chips of paint, you can see also beautiful shine on the paint as well. And when these things are outside in the rain, which is when they come to life with tears, don't they, I believe? Yep. When they come to life, it is a wonderful, wonderful moment. And I believe you got emotional at that point, Paul. Which is quite interesting.
I did. I'm an emotional bloke.
It's an involving story, very involving story, about growing up, toys, the mixed reality and fantasy, you know, what's the difference between the two, when do you believe in one or the other. As an Argentina fan, which I am, surprise, surprise, the football match was superb, as well as the presentation of the football match. It was very South American, which is why a director I'm a fan of, Juan Jose Campanella, to try and make some money back on this ridiculously expensive film, other versions were distributed and retranslated and even remade in some ways to Britify it, to Americanify it, and other ones. So the British version's got Rupert Grint, Peter Serafinovich, Mr. Voice Impressionist, Rob Brydon, and others. But that is very much with Jonathan Pierce doing the commentary and that kind of thing. This is the South American Gold TV commentator, and which I prefer anyway. But that said, it's just a wonderful, wonderful little animation film that I'm glad it has actually had quite a bit of success. Not enough to make money off, by the way. Because I think even Juan Jose Campanella said, every Argentina would have to say would have to pay to see it three times, and it still wouldn't get close to breaking even. I don't know where the hell he got the money from, but he had a bloody good go at making an animation film. His first ever animation film. He normally makes long, slightly boring, but nevertheless well worth watching dramatic pieces. He's also getting quite Hollywood-y. He's done a few TV series, episodes of House.
Yeah.
He also did A Secret in Their Eyes, which was a masterpiece, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. So he's a very capable director, but you never know when these people do animations how it's going to work out. I liked it. You loved it.
I did love it, and I think it is my best animation of the year by far.
Yeah.
I think it was made by someone who loved cinema and loved football and knew football.
That's right.
And that's a big difference.
In every one of his films, that is always football.
Often you get films made about football who are almost done by a committee. They get in a good director who obviously doesn't know much about football, isn't a big fan of football. And in fact, often if directors that do like football steer clear of football, like there's no tomorrow, because they don't want to tarnish it in money. I think Ken Loach is one who's a big football fan, but he's never really made a decent, even tried to make a proper football film. I think the animation quality was excellent.
Yeah,
I loved the kind of the narrative, which was about a kind of human who plays football and loves it. He's intimidated by local children, and then as an adult, and then someone he beat once at football comes back to destroy his town, and then destroys the football ground, and then wants to destroy the town to build a big stadium. He's a kind of a Ronaldo figure of his own, but
he was actually, yeah,
South American, coming back to kind of destroy
attacking Messi.
Given that Ronaldo has built his own museum and statue in his own town, but that's probably for a good thing to
of course, this was made years before that even happened, but he saw it.
Yep,
well done to him.
And so it has everything going for it. It has the right amount of comedy, the right amount of sentimentality, the right amount of a kind of emotional connection. There's the obligatory love story. There's the ridiculousness of the football team saving the real life, who aren't much taller than the grass, saving the kind of the day for the kind of the human football match. It had absolutely everything going for it. I would say see it in the foreign language.
You must.
And I would also say see it with no language. Just go see it in the foreign language and with no subtitles a second time, just to enjoy the spectacle of the colours and the visualisation. And I think the reason for me why it was better than the other animation, The King and the Mockingbird, was partly because it had that extra element of humour and the love of the game that I think Theo and I both have, the love of football, that is rarely captured. And again, the football special showed that to some extent. Football is often so badly done. And in fact, we're doing a football film next year up for one of the Oscar nominations. So that'll be interesting to see. But it just had everything for it. It wasn't too long. It wasn't too short. And it just had everything. And I think kids would love it. Adults would love it. Women would love it who don't even like football, because it's a family film. Yeah, it has so much to it. So absolutely brilliant.
And if it wasn't for the UK remake, this would not even be eligible for our list. So I am very grateful to Rupert Grint, Peter Serafinovich and Rob Brydon. Thank you, guys. Don't watch that fucking version, but thank you very much anyway. Because
absolutely,
I would hate for that film not to be on this list for trivialities. But we do have to keep them, of course.
Yep.
So our penultimate film of 2014, Paul, Nymphomaniac Volume 1 or 2. Now, this is probably we are going to keep this one as short as possible because we dedicated a podcast to it.
We do.
So there's no point treading over all that old ground. But nevertheless, Paul, start us off on what I think is Von Trier's best film.
Absolutely. I think Nymphomaniac 1 and 2, which is a combined total of just under 4 hours.
Or and it does feel like hours. It does.
It's basically a self-diagnosed nymphomaniac recounts her erotic experiences to the man who saved her after a beating. And basically, it's Charlotte Gainsbourg doing what she does best, looking a bit sick.
Wearing little.
Stellan Skarsgård, who I really do love.
Yeah.
Willem Dafoe.
Who doesn't?
Indeed. I presume dentists hate him. I think, again, we dedicate a whole podcast to this. So I think if you're really interested, you can listen to that. But it was a great film in the sense that I think it wasn't about sex. And I think
you go into this religious thing.
Yep. I talk about it saying that actually the only people who can really appreciate this film
are
priests. that's my take on it.
Which is interesting because one of the lead characters is a priest.
Indeed. And I had a very religious upbringing at the school I went to. So I got a lot of the kind of religious elements, which gave it an extra depth. But equally, it's just cracking. I think its use of stars, I think LaBeouf, as we should call him, the beef.
As far as I'm concerned, that is Shia LaBeouf's best performance.
Absolutely.
I'm convinced absolutely. It is.
Doesn't help that he makes shit nearly all the time, but that's neither here nor there.
Sometimes you can carry things above, i.e. Philip Spall Hoffman and Timothy Hoffman.
Timothy Hoffman, as we should now merge Philip Seymour Hoffman and Timothy Spall. Again, a great film. You've got to sit through the whole two parts.
And you will want to do that, by absolutely. The way. You definitely, because it's... Von Trier is the master of chapters.
Yep.
Which is interesting because the final film I'm going to talk about are also essentially flashbacky chaptery things done very, very, very well as well.
Yep.
But this, I would say, is an even better example of chapters. Chapters can be a cheating way to tell a story. But not there's anything wrong with cheating. We've all cheated in the past. But people rely on chapters because they can't actually structure a film or condense a film down adequately. So it becomes into chapters, like, for example, the James Brown biopic, which we both enjoyed.
We did.
Obviously, not good enough to be on this list, but that should not have had any chapters because it didn't add anything to it. Whereas the chapters add things to it because it is like she's sitting there speaking to the priest in this god awful house with dirt on the walls and it's falling apart and all sorts of things.
Welcome to Denmark.
Welcome to Denmark twice. And she really is reading a book, scriptures, which comes into the religious thing, which I will agree mostly with, but of course you tend to take things slightly too far sometimes. I do think the film works as the sex thing, but there is no two ways about it. The religious stuff is there. The half ear relates to having the ear cut off in one of those other old Testament stories. It's just so much of stuff. One final point I think we should both touch on. As Von Trier fans, we would both recommend this for non-Von Trier fans, wouldn't we?
Yes, I'd say...
It's challenging for non-Von Trier fans, but I think this is a bloody good place to start, because if you can deal with this, if you can deal with strange scenes, emotional scenes, ridiculous scenes, fantastic scenes, potentially within the same scene... If you can deal with this, you can deal with anything that any of the most avant-garde directors in the world can throw at you.
Yep.
I mean, we're going into detail about which ones in particular we enjoyed, which scenes. But in effect, they're all good. They're all different scenes that merge well together. There's different styles, as I said. Black and white sometimes, colour other. Emotional sometimes, silent other. Music sometimes, deafness other. It's just an absolute masterpiece from Lars von Trier.
Yep.
And that, in a way, speaks for itself, really.
And listen to the entire podcast dedicated to it.
Indeed. So, final review, final look back time now, Paul. A Story of Jonas Gay. And this feels like a long time ago since we watched this. A Story of Jonas Gay, or as you will see it, A Story of Yonosuke. But because I'm a pretentious knob on this occasion, I like to say how they say it, Jonas Gay. Jonas Gay, it is a film that focuses on the life of one person. Simple as that. Jonas Gay. His life from university until a young death, and all the people he meets and the relationships he makes along the way. In terms of direction, Paul, there can be no doubt this is an absolute classy product.
Oh, totally.
This, for me, is the best ending of any film on this list. It is an outstanding ending, supported, might I add, by a bloody good beginning and middle as well. This is your typical Japanese film about all the stuff that we've banged on about all year round, and yet it does it in spades, and yet it complements Like Father, Like Son, and one of that I'll be talking about shortly. That they appear to be the same, and yet they are totally different films, and yet they work brilliantly together.
Mm-hmm.
When we reviewed this, you mentioned the chaos theory about how one person can affect somebody's life.
Yep.
And also you've mentioned things like acceptance, a general acceptance of, you know, not saying that we should necessarily agree to accept, but generally speaking, the Japanese have an acceptance of their lot, so to speak, and it is their intention, the film director's intention, and the characters in their films, to make the bloody best shot they can at trying to beat modernist Japan versus old Japan, which comes into it with an absolute four with this. This, again, brilliant direction, because flashbacks. Flashbacks were a bone of contention for me, as they are with you. This is one of the few ever films where I've actually really, really enjoyed the use of flashbacks. You never get confused between eras, because it splits into two, pre-university and after university. And it does it, handles it fantastically well. And the bleak, and it is a bleak message, there's a bleak message behind this film, is that Yonosuke affected so many people's lives. So he, in effect, was the embodiment of modern Japan trying to triumph over the traditional repressive nature of Japanese society. He tries to overcome it as best he can. He joins a samba class. He gets into a relationship. He makes his very, very small apartment, which is atypical of traditional society. He makes his very small apartment as beautiful, as light, as airy, as colourful as possible for Christmas. And yet he ends up dying trying to save somebody else who jumps off a railway bridge.
Yep.
And that, I think, is such a powerful message shown in, as I again to repeat, an absolutely brilliant ending, which is not sentimental in any way. It's hard-hitting. And I said, I didn't get emotional, as I said on the podcast, I didn't get emotional behind this. I was left stone cold, emotionless by this ending, because it just ties up everything together beautifully. It's a long film, 2.5 hours or thereabouts.
Knocking on three.
And I don't regret a second of it. I remember calling out one particular scene where he's chasing essentially a whore girl before he gets the proper relationship. Maybe I could have done without that, but I really am forensically picking straws here, because this is an absolute masterpiece. And it's boded well for what came after that, like Father Like Son, Shady to a lesser extent as well, and indeed the film that I'm going to talk about for our bonus film as well, what a powerhouse Japan has turned into for cinema. Mm. And this is a perfect example of it.
Mm. I can't add or take away anything from that, really. I think the only thing I would add is the excellent use of the notion of photography.
Again, well, this specifically photography, yep. And the ending, as we know, Paul, yep. Is?
Remind me.
Photographs are presented.
That's right.
To the girl who obviously survives the relationship, because she carries on living. But why does she survive? Because she went to Paris.
Yep.
And when she came back from Paris, she got out of the repressive society. When she came back, she had an envelope with a bunch of photographs in it, because he wanted to become a photographer. And why did he become a photographer? We don't really know, but we know what it represents.
Yep.
So it all just ties in beautifully.
And again, I love the use of the photography and the flashbacks as being more about memory,
yeah,
rather than kind of like narrative points being clarified so that you can, you know, because you can't think for yourself and you need to be told with a flashback. It's about the memory of a life. And I think that what made this probably the second best Japanese film of the year for me, because I did like Father Like Son so much, partly obviously, because of my personal connection with it. But again, this is up there. And I think, again, like you say, Japanese cinema, fantastic. I wasn't so keen on Shady, and I'm looking forward to what your bonus one is, because I don't know what that is. But again, I would say, absolutely, I think all of these films pretty much are the best films of the year. And Yonosuke and Like Father, Like Son are really the top-notch ones, I think, that are just fantastic.
It's, I mean, and coming from you regarding that it is pushing 3 hours, Mr. Bremer.
Absolutely.
So
you know,
I think that is like me saying that your Japanese film wanted to make me have kids. This, my Japanese film, didn't get you distracted for 3 hours in a film.
Absolutely.
I think we've both made compliments that can't be better than that, really.
Absolutely. And again, they are quality in every respect. Yeah. They look fantastic. They feel fantastic. They don't overkill on dialogue or explanation, yet they explore a depth of emotion that so often European cinema doesn't. And I think it's quite interesting. We don't really have a lot of kind of Western European cinema in the list. But I tell you what is interesting, just having a quick look back, every film apart from one is written and directed by the same person.
Yeah.
Apart from The King and the Mockingbird, which I suspect he even had a hand in the thing. And that's really interesting.
That is interesting.
Because often you can often say that that's probably a little bit too overdone. But not this time, and I think fantastic.
I don't think it can be a coincidence. Yeah. If the director can also write his idea from his head to the page, into screenplay, etc. Yeah. If he's got the confidence to do it and he pulls it off, there can be nothing better than that.
Yeah.
What's interesting about the two Japanese films, before we come to a verdict to each, is that Like Father, Like Son is actually an original screenplay, whereas The Honest Gay is based on a novel, as is, by the way, my bonus film is also based on a novel, but it actually doesn't matter. In other countries, particularly America, it matters very, very much. It doesn't matter here because they are both brilliantly executed in their own ways, and there is no strength or weakness to either of them particularly.
Indeed.
It's just about which ones you obviously connect with more. And I shall be watching as much Japanese cinema as I can in 2015.
Yep.
It is just wonderful at the moment. Really, really great. And I'm so glad I have ditched horror movies for this because it's what they seem to have done, which is marvellous. Verdict time then, Paul. What's your film of 2015?
Like Father, Like Son. I think partly because of all that we've said about it, and then the personal connection to it as well, I think made me have such a link with it, a connection. Again, it's 2 hours, and it has absolutely everything, and it has a depth to it that I think possibly, I would say, the others didn't really match. They came close to, but this had so much in it. Like Father, Like Son, that it was just, I would say, not even close to being matched for me. It wins the film of the year by far.
I'm very surprised. I thought you were gunning for horses.
Well, I did really love that. Did. But I think it had that weakness, is that, like you said, the first 15 minutes are so good that the rest of it can't.
There's an awful lot to be said for consistency.
Absolutely.
A good or great film is better than a film that's outstanding and then drops and then maybe rises again.
Yeah.
You've got to get absolutely that tone exactly.
And Like Father, Like Son is just perfection throughout.
Well, Paul, time for my verdict now. We've watched a lot of different cinema.
We have.
From all over the world, different styles and content, stuff about the meaning of life, stuff about revolutionary society, repressive governments, religious sects, childhood, adulthood, fatherhood, letting go, acceptance, and more. But my film of 2014, Paul, is about a bunch of nerds sitting around talking absolute shit.
Ooh.
Computer chess.
Oh, goodness me. I'm stunned.
I thought you might be. Computer chess seeps ideas and concepts through absolutely every one of its pores.
Worst film on the list.
The chessboard as a metaphor for life. The potential for infinite combinations mixed with the limitations of existence, i.e. black and white filming like a chessboard, and the technology itself struggling to beat the human brain, us struggling to exist in a life. The fact it was set in a hotel with its many rooms, like a chessboard and its squares, and the infinite possibilities of other humans meeting together in the hotel, i.e. the funny swingers group, who are also, well, essentially swingers, sexual health well-being group. And of course, a rather bizarre case of a robot prostitute at the end. Now, if you don't care about any of that stuff, and I'm sure most people won't, ironically enough, it's also a love story between a man and technology. The story of men via computers and the story of computers via men.
I can see why you didn't say much about it when we were talking
Does
about
anybody...
it. You were saving it to the end.
Does that sound familiar to Of Horses and Men? Yes, I think it's a companion piece to that. Now, best of all, if that wasn't enough, Paul, if you are not interested in any of that either, then I say, for me, the film is witty, sharp and amusing and entertaining in at least one of those fields. Now, this is my most important point. It's worth repeating that this is not for everyone. And I said that at the time, I said it when we reviewed, I said it today and I'm saying it again. But this is my point. When should a film be for everybody? If you are appealing to the masses and satisfying everybody at the same time, you're in the wrong business, except for making money. This film challenges and requires you to think. It tests you we are poor, are we not in the medium of the habit of watching this medium poor, where by its very nature, in the best of examples, we are encouraged to be active participants, like father, like son. You do have to work in it, albeit easier, because the ideas are presented to you clearer, and in fact, generally speaking, better in like father and like son. But nevertheless, engaging, being active in this film, it is essential. This absolute gem of a film is my film of 2014, Paul. A masterpiece. Yes, a masterpiece made with hardly any money, but absolutely worth an investment of your own. And if you don't, and if you don't like it, then it's doing its job. That is my film. I've blown away by its originality. I've seen nothing since or before Computer Chess.
It's different, and I'll give you that. For me, it's
the most important thing. Whether liking it or disliking it, that of course is subjective, but we can definitely agree that it's different. And for a film to stand out as different and original in this day and age, even for American indie cinema, and a Ping Pong Summer, again, this came before it. So even this thing has been done again. Mm-hmm. And as you say, someone might take the idea and actually make a better film of it. I don't dispute that for a moment. But this product is terrific, not necessarily in terms of enjoyment or entertainment value, but the whole...
That's definitely true.
The whole thing, as a period piece, as everything, it's just a thing that needs to be seen. I would say 75% of people won't like it. But again, that's not the point. It needs to be seen, just like for this, just like Father Like Son needs to be seen, for different reasons. And I think those two are perfect winners, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm very glad we both choices.
Yep.
And yet we're not finished.
We're not.
Because as a bonus, lest we forget that we watch films outside of the podcast. Quite a few, I would imagine.
Indeed.
So we don't want to let some slip that we didn't have time to review, because we've had a lot of Oscar ones to look at. We've had a lot of personal choices that we thought we'd be interested in. Also ones that we think each other would be interested in. And obviously, some at the bottom of the list that we just don't have time for don't get talked about on the podcast. This is what this spot is for. So, Paul, what is the best film that you want to recommend to people that you have not reviewed on the podcast?
It's called Des Jeux Ennuis, call 2 Days, One Night. It's not French, it's Belgian. It's made by the Dardenne brothers, and starring the legend that is Marion Cotillard. Although her attraction, kind of physical attraction, everybody thinks she's incredibly beautiful, I must admit, does escape me.
And me, actually. She's a good actress, though.
Absolutely. She's a fantastic actress in Rust and Bone, and I think she is one of the great French actresses.
Rust and Bone was awful.
But, she's good in it. Yeah. But equally, and it is quite odd, because, again, the French often have these really beautiful women that everyone says really beautiful, but you think, ooh. I don't quite see that. But she's a great actress. And basically, it's the story of a young Belgian mother called Sandra, who works in a factory, and the workers are told, I will either sack her and you can have your bonus, the rest of the workers can have their bonus, or you don't get your bonus and we keep her. And so she's then, they have this ballot, and you don't really see that, and they choose to take the bonus and get rid of her. And then the manager agrees to have another vote on the following Monday, where he says basically, well, if you can convince them to vote differently on Monday, you can keep your job, but they don't get their bonus. And it's her going around asking people to vote to keep her, and that's it.
That's it.
It's a film of today. It's a film about socialism. It's a film about capitalism. It's a film about relationships. It's a film about workers. It's a film about families. It's a film about unity. And it's not as miserable as it sounds. I'm not going to tell you how it ends, but I love the ending, because I was thinking, how are they going to do this for it to come with something additional to the kind of the idea and the philosophy behind it? And it does that perfectly. She's a strong woman. She's had a mental breakdown in the past that you gather throughout the narrative. She's struggling to cope, which I think is true of a lot of ordinary working class people in contemporary society. You know, the husband's having to do this awful job as well to survive. They can't survive. Some of the people say they will change their vote out of solidarity, out of love for her. Others say they won't. because they need the money. They're in those equally desperate straits. And, you know, and then some are just greedy because they want to do an extension. And some are just stupid and sort of naive and whatever. And it follows that. It's a snappy 95 minutes. It's well made, well directed. Very kind of low key. Marion Cotillard is fantastic in it.
Typical miserable Belgian film.
It's a lot more hopeful than that. Actually.
I need this. And again, I might actually give this a chance.
The ending was not what I thought, and it added
so
to.
So who are the Dardens?
The Dardens. They did The Boy on the Bike, and they are a kind of they make very kind of political, miserable, kind of Belgian cinema. That I think we have reviewed in the past, one or two of theirs, probably not in this.
Don't
podcast.
Put me off. You're doing quite well at the moment.
But again, and it's just it was full of hope.
Good.
Actually,
I need
hope combined with realism and joy in the end. I thought that actually a lot of the thing we've talked about, the women and the like, the strong women that you like, and the ordinariness and the extraordinariness and the hopelessness, it's all in there, and it comes out. And it made me feel happy for the nature of the film. I think it did win in Cannes and it did win in Berlin for different things. Best actress, probably best film at Cannes. I think Timothy Spall won best actor. And absolutely, I loved it. And again, I put off seeing it for quite a while because I was a bit concerned it wouldn't be very good and a bit miserable. And it's always not good where they put
and it might well be these things
a beautiful star in it,
yeah.
Sort of being ordinary, but she's fantastic, so everything went for it.
I will actually watch this, you've convinced me. Excellent. I must say, now my bonus film, going back to Japan, Paul. Remarkably so. Now it wasn't necessarily planning to be this way. I did have a little Mexican film lined up, but I'm keeping that to myself. Some things you do have to keep to yourself, because I love fucking miserable films. Sometimes I do.
I've gathered that.
I really do. This is called The Great Passage. The Great Passage. I've even mentioned it on the previous podcast, Paul.
Have you?
I tried my very best to find something to ensure it wouldn't yet be yet another Japanese loving on the podcast. Hence why this Mexican film is almost there. The Colombian film La Playa DC had a good fist of an attempt as well. The Great Passage. The Great Passage, however, won out. It refers to the name of a 21st century dictionary that will act as a boat to connect people across the sea of words. Mahime is the newest member for the dictionary department, and he must make his contribution whilst discovering what journey he must take on his own life. As I've said already, Paul, Japan has developed into a real insurmountable powerhouse over this year. A tour de force of filmmaking, not just on the podcast, but also for this one, for example. Lots of good Japanese quality products presented in interesting ways with lots of content. This has all the traits we've come to expect and we've talked about so far and previously. The generational gap. This, like Yonosuke, is split into two. 90s and then the new decade. In the 90s, of course, and the problems that come with that. For example, the rise of the e-dictionary. The fact that a lot of the terms have since been modernised and have changed. So they've had to go back and change all things and bring people in who are all expert on the fashion terms, the working terms, the sporting terms and all that kind of thing. Indeed, and he just pointed out to me, this is the point I was going to come to. This, not like Father Like Son, not Yonosuke, not Shady, this was the film that was nominated for the 2014 Oscar list and it didn't make it. Now, the fact of the matter is that all three maybe not Shady, but the other three films should have made it onto the final list. Never mind the one Japanese film. So this is how good the strength in depth is in terms of Japanese cinema. So this one has other things, as well as it being similar to Yonosuke. This has another angle to it. And that's the idea. And this is going back to something we talked about for a documentary special, Paul. And the culture of working, because of course the sushi film, the sushi documentary,
yep,
that is about a very, 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 very old. He's worked in that business for 60, 70 years, and he literally will not stop until he's dead. When you work on a dictionary in Japan, you are literally dedicating 18 years at least of your life to working on this dictionary, and this is full not only of the nuances of working on a dictionary, for example. the methodology, which is the traditional way of writing, carrying cards around, listening to what words people are saying, scribbling the notes down, the use of contention, what the words actually are going to mean, how you're going to describe them in the dictionary without plagiarising other dictionaries. The traditional form of creating dictionaries still takes a long, long time. And of course, you'd think in Japan now they probably don't even have any at all. So it's bringing back the New Japan versus the old. The upstairs, in the book publishing company, has newer offices. The rooms are whiter. The technology is more up to date. Whereas downstairs, one of the people in the dictionary department has just picked up a PDF reader for the first. A PDA reader for the first time. Downstairs in the dictionary department, it's darker, it's dingier, the people are uglier, whereas upstairs they are prettier and obviously happier. Now this, again, similar to all the Japanese films we talked about, this is also a film not only about working, as we've said, but it's about acceptance. The journey you have to take must be completed to the best of your ability. Whether you want to be a photographer in Yonosuke, whether you want to be a father in your father's son, you can only surely do the best that you can do in the repressed society that Japanese people are undoubtedly in. Having something to believe in to escape from the repression, whether it's a new son, an old son, whether it's a class, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a dictionary. It all ties in beautifully together. Sometimes you win, like the father wins in like Father Like Son. Sometimes you lose, like Yonosuke. The dictionary and the people working on it acts as a metaphor for their own journey through their life. We laugh at them. We are sad with them where it's appropriate. There is also a romance in this film as well. It's a splendid piece of cinema.
And I shall check it out.
You're going to have to.
You made me want to watch it.
You're going to have to.
What more can I say?
It works on the dictionary level, the romance level, and even higher Japanese film cultural level.
Depth.
Depth.
Depth and insight.
Full of depth and dictionaries.
Excellent.
Depth and dictionaries. There we go. I think that's pretty much it for the podcast for 2014.
And let's look forward to all those foreign films, that wealth of foreign films and the occasional crap English one.
I look forward to hearing your personal crap. You must do better, Paul, because lest we forget, this list is lacking a Paul Dark film on it this year. Whereas the year before, well, actually, as it turned out, my winner last year was a joint one, which was The Master. And for you, it was your Dutch film.
Yep.
Matterhorn. But the year before that, I actually picked one of your films, and it was a French film of all things that won my film of the year.
Do you remember what that was? Your memory is so impressive. You make me feel so old. I don't remember
Untouchables.
Memory.
The Untouchables.
That's right.
Not only was it French, but it was a disability film, which was it even did. More amazing. What was my film?
I'll
of
get
year.
You another French disability film.
I did say I have a cut down on that, so I'm going to hold on to that. But I expect you to come back fighting next year, Paul.
Indeed.
In fact, probably starting with 2 days, one night. Before we get to next year's podcast. But once again, I saw you want to say something, Paul?
No, I just think it shows that people need to look outside
Absolutely.
Of the Cineplex.
Absolutely.
End of story.
That is the whole point of us and why we hope you've enjoyed it. We know you have because we've seen the figures. Thank you very, very much for downloading us. The only thing left to say is Happy New Year, and we will see you next year in February 2015. Goodbye for now.
Good stuff.
So you really do need to get a grip, Paul. There's so much shit that you put forward.